All right, you want to start this?
Sure.
Welcome back to the Fear the Wall podcast. My name is Gregory Horn, the local cynic, as always. And today we have Nick Capitos, if I'm saying that correctly.
You are, Greg. You are.
And we are finally doing another episode after a very inconsistent start to this podcast because we all have time restraints.
Because of life. Because of life.
Especially with the season stopping and starting again, mm-hmm. and a wild summer.
And yeah, there's only really so much you can talk about when the season goes on pause for like a couple months, and then off season isn't anywhere close to normal. But it's good. We're back. You know, we're back.
I think we're finally back in a little bit of swing of things. You know, fall's rolling around, and I think, especially as a student myself, you know, just back into the swing of school. So it's just nice to be back. So let's start off and talking about, you know, the Bundesliga is finally back.
Thank God.
We all have the expectation that Bayern will once again win the Bundesliga.
Yep.
Especially after that performance. Where, you know, Schalke really stood no chance, but, you know, that's what happens when you sell your best player. Well,
you loan your best player. With the option to buy, yes, but it's still technically a loan. For those that don't know, we're talking about Weston McKennie, American for Schalke. He moved to, surprisingly, Juventus over the off season, and because of that, Schalke, I put them as heavy favorites to be relegated. And Weston McKennie can, you know, starting for Juventus can kind of rope into Schalke being a dumpster fire.
I've never really, like, I'll criticize Schalke's transfer on that because, yes, he was a highlight on their team, but I've never really been that high in McKennie. Like, to me, I think he's like...
He's like a safety. He's a strong safety in football. Like, he's there defensively. He's not going to get you a lot of interceptions or turnovers. Like, he's not going to – like, he's going to get you a lot of tackles, a lot of – you know, a lot of passes broken up. And maybe he'll contribute on, like, returns or something like that. Like, he's a defensive specialist. And that's fine.
To me, he's a rich man, Scott McTominay.
Uh-huh.
Which isn't a bad thing. It's just like I think, especially when you come to like Juventus, right?
Yeah.
There's gonna be super high expectations of what he's actually gonna do, but really, like, he just needs to get the ball, protect the back line, and keep possession. And on a side like Juve, you know, that's not too hard to do.
Yeah.
Especially when you have Aaron Ramsey progressing the ball next to you, and you have and you have Rabiot also. I mean, I think he'd work perfectly next to Rabiot in that way. But
mm-hmm. Yeah, he did. I don't really know how good Sampdoria is, but he still did like really well. He almost had 2 goals on his debut, which is insane. Like U.S. soccer Twitter, I think would have had like a nuclear meltdown if that happened.
I just don't think he's like. You know, I think everyone excited about Pulisic, right? Okay, fair. Mm-hmm. But I can see that effect of that overhyping of Pulisic coming back into play when it comes to McKennie now that he's at a big club and like putting in solid performances. Like he has the potential to be a very solid defensive midfielder, but especially if you're limiting his role. That allows him to be that much better of a player than he actually is.
Yeah. I don't know. It could be the case of, like, he was limited. Like, you saw a lot of the parts of his game that needed to be improved because of he was the best player on Schalke, so they're expecting him to be an attacking presence, which he's not exactly, while being a defender, which he is, and he's surrounded by not that good players and poor coaching. Whereas it's Juventus, like, it's the best team in Italy. Pirlo's unproven as a manager, but, you know, give him a game, give him like a set game plan and a set position to play, and I think he'll give you a solid 90 minutes. Because I'm sure, like, I think the only positions that Westman didn't play at Schalke were was goalkeeper. I just remember seeing the lineups and he was playing like everywhere.
I remember him playing center forward because Schalke didn't have a center forward anymore.
Right, and he's such a presence in the air. Like, you just lob across it, and Adar is going to get ahead to it.
I mean, I think he's a good player. I just don't, you know, I don't think he's a world-class creative player. I don't think he's a. I think he does what he does very well.
Mm-hmm.
I think in the right team, that could be awesome. I don't think we've learned enough about his press resistance. Like, you know, like comparing him to someone like Thiago or Axel Witsel. You know, that's just not a reality.
Yeah, like that's not the kind of player that he is.
And that's
something that I think that he can learn at Juventus. Like, he's got, I think, some of the best players in the world around him. You know, like, hopefully he's going to learn, and that's really all you can hope for.
Yeah, that's fair.
Especially with a club that has financial struggles, you know, you tend to want that money up front. And then I also think the strategy of limiting all your players to $2 million salary isn't the best move in terms to grow the club and push it in the right direction, especially if there is that player that can keep you afloat.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they're just a story of mismanagement from the coaching standpoint and from the executive and front office standpoint and not being able to evolve as a club.
Right. There was a tweet, I want to say right around the time that the Bundesliga restarted, that it was just like this big list of all of the players that have come from Schalke in the last 3 or 4 years that they have either sold for below value, like Brielle Mbolo, I hope I'm saying his name correctly, or just straight up let go for free. And it doesn't take someone, you know, you could be someone who's never watched a game of soccer in their life, and you tell them this, and you say, yeah, that's bad business.
I think also a thing that comes into play, right, is Bayern's attraction when it comes to pulling players that have a year or two left on their contracts. And you certainly could have gotten money from Max Meyer. You certainly could have gotten money for Goretzka, but then Goretzka leaves for free to Bayern, where they more than likely tripled his salary. I don't think there are a lot of clubs in the world or even in the Bundesliga that can compete with that, especially if a player wants to stay in Germany.
Definitely, definitely not in Germany. I mean, the only clubs that are comparable to that in a financial sense are the oil clubs. You know, your PSGs, your Manchester Cities, you know, I mean, like, yeah, I'm trying to think, like, wasn't Leroy Sané's salary increased by, like, such a stupid amount going from City to Bayern?
Yeah, I mean, I think Bayern pays their players on an average, if I think I saw the statistic on Twitter, I don't know who exactly tweeted it, but they pay their players an average of, I think, 15 to 20 million per year in euros. And Dortmund has, I think, an average of about 7 or 8.
Yeah, that sounds about right. I mean, how are you supposed to compete with that unless you, you know, drink that poison chalice of Russian sugar daddy or like a oil, you know, like oil money.
Well, even then, oil money didn't really prevent Schalke from being a shitty team.
True, that's financial mismanagement, but they would at least have that, you know, that oil money, that oligarch money to fall back on. Whereas now they're having to, you know, cross their fingers and hope that, you know, the academy kids pan out.
I think entirely, and I think that's where, you know, Dortmund has evolved into a next generation club, where you look at, rather than actually building academy products, can you take academy products and refine them? Because that's where you can maximize on profits compared to actually the diminishing returns of producing an academy player and losing him for cheaper to someone else's latter stages of an academy in terms of the U19s or the under 23s, where they can jump into the first team.
Mm-hmm.
This time.
Yeah, it's a tight line to balance whether you're a feeder club or a buyer club, and it seems that Dortmund they're striking a nice balance where they're able to go into these big academies like Manchester City and get these, you know, high profile academy players that they're not quite ready for the Premier League, but they're too good for the under 23s. And turn them into superstars that they will eventually, you know, sell for money that you and I could only dream of making in a lifetime.
I mean, the most recent player that Zorc has pulled away from Manchester City is a 16-year-old youngster from their academy team who has the same agent as Sancho.
Mm-hmm.
And the layout plan is a year in the under 19s and then push him into the senior team. And probably towards the end of that year, getting genuine game time with the first team. So there is a road for these players.
The player that we're talking about is Jamie Bino Gittens, JBG, trademark by Fear the Wall. I know like nothing about this kid, and that's what he is. He's a kid, but Mikael Zorc's track record in unearthing these, you know, wonder kids, it speaks for itself. So I'm gonna trust Zorc on this one.
Well, I think also it's perfect timing considering. It's perfect timing with when Zorc gets these kids out of England, especially with England's having English clubs refining their academies in recent years, especially City, Liverpool, places like that, trying to improve their academies so that they have a path to the first team. Mm-hmm. But with Brexit, from what I understand, a lot of these players are able to leave on compensation rather than actually for a transfer fee.
Right.
And so that compensation, you know, with Sancho, it was £7 million. With Bellingham, I'm pretty sure there was some weird finagling going on. Whether he renewed his contract with Birmingham, I don't know, but I'm pretty sure he wanted to get the most out of Dortmund in terms of a quote unquote transfer fee of $25 million that Dortmund are sure to get back, because I'm relatively sure Birmingham has had financial troubles in the last couple of years.
Yeah, this Jude Bellingham, his move, I would say, definitely saved Birmingham from fates. You know, like Southampton in the past. Paul, if you're listening, I'm sorry for bringing this up. Like Bury, like Bolton, you know, clubs like that that rely on transfer fees and sell on fees. You know, like a move like that for Birmingham City probably saved the club. It's weird that modern football is like that. You know, like either you let go of your best players and, you know, like you keep a revolving door, or you hold on to your best players without any chance of getting of promoting, and you're probably not going to last very long unless you have, you know, solid financial backing, which not a lot of teams have.
Which is why I'm pretty sure Bellingham and Birmingham and cue the jokes, of course, but they retired his jersey, which was quite funny, but
it's very funny.
But I think, you know, there's obviously context there and a reasoning for what he represents to the club and what the club represents to him.
Yeah, because he was there since he was, what, like 9? Roughly? Yeah. I mean, he's as much of that club. That's his identity. Like, I was a Birmingham player, and now he's bossing one of the top teams in the Bundesliga at 17 years old, which is just, it's crazy to see.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure in a couple of years we'll see him go, much like Sancho will probably next summer.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's been the entire saga of the summer. I've heard way too much in terms of Twitter experts from Man U talking about, oh, Woodward's going to place a bid all the way at the end of the window. But I'm just not having it, and I trust any journalist that has sources in Germany, especially Ruhr Nachrichten, RN, who are like tight with the front office in Dortmund. So
It is funny to see Man United fans on Twitter and just English journalists as a whole just throwing shit at a wall and seeing what sticks with Jaden, because it's all for clicks when there's like no factual evidence behind it. It's not even Jadon Sancho, like he's holding it up because they've agreed to personal terms. It's just Manchester United not wanting to, you know, put the bid in.
I mean, I think we've all heard the story so far is that, you know, Zouk obviously gave Manu a window of about a week, put in your bid to acceptable terms. There isn't really a whole lot of negotiating going on. It's either you pay up or you don't.
Mm-hmm.
And without Sancho posturing for a move after that, there really is no negotiation power for Man U. I think for a lot of those British journalists, though, if you look at that, whether it's clicks, but I think also another perspective is that Man U, when transfer business does go on, I think a lot of stuff tends to leak from their front office and their intentions. And while I think we all make fun of the British rumor mill that goes around, I think a lot of news tends to come out of that front office camp in Manchester compared to almost no information coming out of Dortmund's camp. While, you know, stuff may leak, for example, Meunier, I mean, we all heard stuff dating back to February about him potentially going to Dortmund. Nothing was confirmed until he was in a black and yellow jersey, even though that contract was signed in February.
Yeah. Yeah, it's the football manager technique. You unsettle the player with leaking stuff, you know, with just like, hey, we really want you. If you could just be kind of a little shit for a while, then we can help you make your move, you know? Like what Ousmane Dembele did with Barcelona, leaving for whatever ungodly sum that was, and he forced it. And the funny thing is that move kind of helped, I think, lead Dortmund to where they are now. And it's Jadon Sancho is not that kind of person, so it's not really working. And credit again to Mikael Zorc for putting that bid, like that hard deadline. It's April, August, whatever. Either pay us the money however you want. Well, not however you want, but like just pay us the 120 million and he's yours. And United's not playing ball, so Dortmund's like, all right, well, it's done. You know, we're not going to fall for it.
I mean, I think, right, whether those leaks were intentional or not, I think certainly some of them could have been.
Mm-hmm.
But also when you have a front office probably that large, I would think that a lot of stuff tends to get out. And I think that's probably a frustration among the higher-ups within United of how much information does get out and how much information does get to the public about their intentions and about their transfer targets and about what they're planning.
Which is, that's a problem on Manchester United's ownership, which that's a whole other conversation for like another day.
Yeah. Entirely.
But yeah, it is strategic, I think. Again, it's the unsettling the player technique where, you know, sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. And this is the instance where it doesn't, and United look foolish. And to our enjoyment.
Entirely. And even with Dembele, right?
Yeah.
Zouk still got the money. He still got the bag. And I think there might have been a little bit of negotiating, but ultimately Barcelona paid their price.
Right.
And Zouk was just like, this is the money demand. And I think probably after that deadline hit, Man U probably had about a week, maybe 10 days to make a deal. But in order to get Zouk back to the negotiating table, it would have been a premium above the original asking price.
Yeah, because that's like,
You pay a fee in order to get Zouk back to the negotiating table.
Exactly. And like I can understand some people's complaints. Like it is like a weird time now with COVID affecting a lot of teams financially. But if you make I don't know how to phrase this. It's basically like, you know, that it's the price set that the seller set, and if you're not gonna pay it or if you're gonna dance around that, then what are we doing?
Yeah, exactly. Especially with the week after Zouk setting that deadline, training camp started in Bad Ragaz in Switzerland. You wouldn't have had time to find a replacement. Or that replacement being able to train with the team for a prolonged period of time. 2 weeks later, the season starts against Duisburg, and then after that, against Gladbach. And there clearly is a timetable where it's no longer acceptable for Jayden to move to Manchester.
Right.
And that timetable, that expiration date, hit a while ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think there's any way he leaves now. It's off the table.
And it's not like United's making themselves that much of a desirable, you know, destination to begin with. Like they got beat by Crystal Palace. That is a team that, like, I am not a Manchester United fan in the slightest, but that is a team that United should lose to maybe once in a blue moon. And maybe this was that situation, but it's just a sign of, I think, how far United have fallen under the Glazers and with, you know, Ed Woodward as their Mikhail Zorc.
I think it's a sign of United having an unqualified coach at times who has struggled against teams that sit back.
Mm-hmm.
I also think that if United aren't willing to pay $120 million for Sancho, they're dumb. Sancho
is
easily the best player in the Bundesliga last season, bar maybe potential Ballon d'Or winner Lewandowski.
Right. Well, I agree 100%.
And, you know, give it any other year, I think you probably would have had conversations about Sancho going for at least $150.
Oh, yeah. Like, he, Jadon Sancho is everything an English team should be looking for. He's young. He's English. He's really, 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 really freaking good. And with a lot of these teams, especially Manchester United, he's at a position that they desperately need on that left wing or right wing, whichever position that they want him to play on. they should have been tripping over themselves to sign Jadon Sancho, because you can make up some of that money in commercial merchandising sales. I'm convinced. They were just trying to be stingy and trying to use their name brand weight to push around Dortmund.
I mean, with the commercial merchandise sales, right? When you go into the analysis of that, when Juve signed that kit deal with Adidas, and also I think Man U also have a kit deal with Adidas. Adidas pays close to I need to look at the numbers again, but I'm certainly it was in the hundreds of millions of dollars to get a kit deal done. Mm-hmm. The only way they make money back is if they take at least 90% of the profits from each kit sold. And I think Man U make about £5 per kit sold.
Jeez. I didn't realize it was that little.
Well, that's how Adidas makes money, right?
Right.
How Nike makes money. That's how they make money on these kit deals that are absurd, that are, you know, I think when Bayern renewed with Adidas, it was $300 million. When I think Man U's, I'm not sure if I remember correctly, but I think it might have been 10 years and I think at least half a billion. So you're talking about a lot of money up front, but then Adidas is making a lot of that money back in the long term, so it's a lucrative deal for both clubs, for both parties.
Mm-hmm.
That said, I think Sancho pays dividends with his creativity and ability to actually win titles.
Yeah, he's a piece that you build around, which Dortmund happened to have a lot of, and a lot of them were on display this past Saturday in the season opener against Gladbach.
I think one more point with Sancho, though, right? Last point. I think a statement Paul has said in the past is, right, is if there's a player that good that will improve your team with dividends shown, any price in order to get that player, such as Virgil van Dijk, such as
Pulisic, such as Tino, yeah, all the guys that Chelsea have signed this summer.
That good in order to actually transform your team in a positive direction that much is worth the price.
Mm-hmm. 100%.
And that shows.
Yes. Yes, it does.
Moving on to, I don't know if we want to talk about Gladbach right now, or do you want to talk about Duisburg?
There's not really much to talk about with Duisburg. I mean, it was the first starts for a couple of our new signings. We absolutely rolled a three-league team, as Dortmund should have. I was a little bullish on Dortmund in my match preview of that. Just, you know, like recent first round matches being a bit of a struggle for them. So it was nice to see them kind of have their way with their opponent in the opening round of the Pokal.
I think there were a couple players that stood out in this game, namely Jude Bellingham, and probably, if I remember correctly, also Giovanni Reyna.
Mm-hmm.
I think Bellingham showed the potential of what he could be while playing against teams that were less skilled than the opponents that he faced in the championship last year. And I think that really showed at times his athleticism and his just IQ in general, especially as such a young player. Like, mm-hmm. Immaturity showed when he got that yellow card, but, you know, he's
17
years old. That's not really too big of an issue.
Right.
And then we also saw Thorgan Hazard at wingback, which I think I've always been a supporter of. While I would have been more supportive if I saw him on the right side, where I think he's more comfortable than on the left side.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree with that. Thorgan Hazard at wingback, it's interesting to me. I hate to bring up Football Manager again, but It's the you have too many good wingers. Try someone at wingback. Try and turn them into a wingback. And it worked. It worked against an inferior opponent. Would that have, and I understand that, you know, Dortmund have a lot of injuries at that position. But I don't know how well that would have worked against Gladbach for more than 15 minutes that we saw Thorgan Hazard. I don't know how that would do against Champions League opponents, against Bayern. You know, so it was a nice experiment to see in the Pokal against, again, an inferior opponent.
I don't necessarily agree with that. I think he's always shown to be the best, one of the best pressers in the team, one of the most productive wingers defensively, at least, in the team. And I think his skill set, especially his more creative skill set rather than finishing skill set, really shows at wingback. While I think he definitely is an inferior player compared to Guerrero at that position.
Mm-hmm.
I think in long term we will be able to see that. But I also think if you give him the time to actually improve as a player and be more comfortable on that spot, I think he would be a decent player there. But I also question its long term legit.
I'd be fine with seeing him in that position, like if he were to come on in subs or again against inferior opponents like a Duisburg or any of like the bottom tier Bundesliga teams. I just wasn't crazy about seeing him in that starting position against Gladbach.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you kind of just don't really have a choice against Gladbach. Until he gets injured and Felix Passlack comes on, which, you know, I think was a surprise to us all. I think we were all excited to see it.
I guess I was excited to see it. You know, Felix Passlack, he's the guy that we've sent on loan, what, the last three seasons to Hoffenheim and Telstar, or no, not Telstar. I think it was like Fortuna Sittard, however you pronounce them, in the Dutch Eredivisie. Eerste Divisie or whatever division they're in the Dutch tiers. So, you know, it was good to see him. I thought for someone that hadn't played in a Dortmund shirt in a meaningful game in a very long time, he did well. I'd like to see him do more, you know. But, you know, there's things he can improve on. There's things he did really well. It was a good performance from Passlack, given that I definitely didn't have any expectations for him.
I don't think any of us did, but I also think he made the most out of the opportunity. While I don't necessarily think that Gladbach were certainly poised to take advantage of him, I think tactically the way they lined up was to try to exploit the right side of Dortmund's defense and kind of attack Chan more, more than Akanji. And I think that showed with Jonas Hofmann playing on the left wing and their version of a 3-4-3 with kind of a false nine. And I think they did well to pressure that right side in the first half. And I think after that first goal, Gladbach didn't really pressure as much and didn't really pose as much of a threat as in the first 25 minutes.
Yeah, I would say inside of that first 25 minutes, it was fairly even. I would give the slight edge, to Dortmund. But yeah, they were attacking our right-hand side with Chan and Meunier, I'd say very, very effectively. They pressed Chan into making a very, very, very stupid giveaway for someone of Chan's professional experience, and he ended up fouling. I do think the first goal scored by Gio Reyna forced them to switch up their tactics a little bit, and then from then on, it was, I think it was just all Dortmund, except for like maybe like a spurt in that second half where they were going for another goal, or when, you know, Gladbach was going for their, trying to pull one back.
I think Gladbach's press really makes you analyze the differences in the in Favre's 3-5-2 rather than Favre's 3-4-3, and having the extra winger on each side really helps that outlet pass from Witzel to a winger, which really wasn't that option there, especially with Klama and Neuhaus in the center mid kind of doing a good job of covering all the holes. And I think there were numerous times where Bellingham tried to force it in transition against one of those two center midfielders who are both experienced players, who are both veterans and know how to handle themselves competitively as at least very solid to very good center midfielders in the Bundesliga. And I think Bellingham's inexperience certainly showed in the first half against them.
Yeah, there were some points where I think, you know, you said it, Bellingham's age showed, where he tried to force things or he tried to do a little bit too much. You know, but again, like as time went on, he, you know, I think Dortmund were able to figure it out, which is, you know, exactly what you hope for.
Although I think also, right, Can finding more and more space over the course of the first half to be able to progress the ball out of that right-hand side. I mean, it was his cross into Gio Reyna in the first place when it found Bellingham, who eventually played it onto Reyna again for the goal.
Mm-hmm.
It was Can's ability to find that space and move further forward up the pitch that really built that goal. So, you know, eventually that press on the down the right-hand side of Dortmund's attack really paid dividends in terms of getting a goal and then progressing from there.
Yeah. Let's talk about that goal by Reyna for a little bit. It took me a couple of watches to notice this again, but Gio's first touch, which is normally for someone his age very good, it let him down. You know, because he kind of mishandled that, and it bounced straight to a Gladbach player. I couldn't identify who it was. And then Bellingham was there to clean it up. Excellent control by Bellingham in that tight area, by the way. And then it's just a nifty little pass to Reyna, and Reyna runs into space and nutmegs the Gladbach defender for the goal.
I think this was a game more where Gladbach's mistakes allowed Dortmund to win rather than Dortmund actually winning the game, if you know what I'm saying.
Yeah.
I think that was a situation very much so where it just makes me think of playing in high school and my coach just always telling me, no matter what, don't let the ball bounce more than once.
Mm-hmm.
In the 18-yard box. Don't give the ball that much time. Don't give your opponent that much time. Worst comes to worst, boot it out.
You know?
If you can't find the space, if you can't find the time, you don't allow other players to take advantage of you and the ball dropping. You know? And I think Bellingham did very well to grab the ball there when it was presented to him. And it was a very nice run by Gio Reyna. And I think Gladbach's center backs really gave that goal up.
Yeah, it was definitely a game of Gladbach making mistakes and Dortmund pouncing on them and Gladbach unable to capitalize on Dortmund's mistakes, because there were a few. I forget what minute it was, but it was Berkey's double save, I would say, was you know, like we let a ball into the box kind of fall to the Gladbach player. I can't think of who took the shot, and a good foot save by Berkey, and then him swatting it away prevented it from being an early 1-0 deficit.
Entirely, and I think Berkey deserves more credit for his performance last game when it comes to actually preventing that initial goal. And, you know, as we saw with the rest of the game, that initial goal really allowed Domina to just take advantage. I think so. That's something we haven't seen in a long time is, I think we all have grown frustrated with Domina sitting on a 1-0 lead rather than actually putting the game to bed.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this really was a change of pace where, you know, that second goal came and then that third goal and the game was as much as gone.
Yeah. Let's talk about that second goal for a little bit. Reyna, again, involved in the play. He's charging the box and he gets clipped by the trailing foot of the Gladbach player. He kind of dove. I'm not afraid to admit that he kind of dove. But again, still, like, it's good awareness of Reyna, who is, again, he's 17 years old, and he's, you know, starting ahead of Marco Reus and Julian Brandt. And yeah, I think that was a move beyond his age for Reyna on that one.
I think it's one situational awareness. I think that he definitely got clipped. I mean,
he got clipped. I don't think it was enough for to take him down. He could have, I think, kept going. But again, still, like, it's good situational awareness to know I'm in the box. I got clipped. If I go down, chances are good I'm gonna get a penalty.
I think also I watched the replay after and kind of tried to watch it over a couple times to really understand what happened there. And so I think he got clipped starting going down a little bit, and then I think he got clipped once again with the defender's knee against his leg too, or against his kind of his ankle, and then that really I think really sold that penalty.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was a small thing, but I think, you know, it really forwarded his momentum more, or however you want to look at that. I think it really sold the PK more. While on the other hand, Hummels almost gave away a PK.
Should have. It should have.
And I think we all agree that, you know, he didn't go for the ball. He didn't hit the ball. And both players ultimately went down. And that should have been a PK to pull the game back for Gladbach in that situation.
Yeah, if I'm a Gladbach fan, that's a moment where it's like, all right, we're not winning this one today. That's a clear penalty. Like you said it, Hummels wasn't going for the ball, shoved the player in the back, in the box, player goes down. That's a penalty, you know. It should be a penalty at least. But you know, that's just the way the ball rolled that day.
I mean, I would argue, right, especially with our expectations for Hummels, that he was the worst player in a Dortmund kit that day. You know, I think the only other argument would be for Meunier, who didn't really have a flashy performance, but he certainly didn't make many mistakes. While Hummels, you know, he followed a couple of runners, especially with Lars Stindl playing that false nine, and he kind of ventured out of the box and was forced to chase their runs back into the box a couple of times.
Mm-hmm.
He made that almost costly mistake with that potential penalty, and he certainly wasn't as instrumental with creating goal chances or playing balls into the final 30 as he usually is.
Yeah, he was uncharacteristically poor, and someone, you know, especially when he is the highest signing, the highest transfer fee in Dortmund history. You expect him to be better with, you know, the amount of domestic and international experience he has. You know, you expect more from Hummels. And then we saw someone who, you know, Manuel Akanji, who everyone just loves to, you know, scapegoat as not a good defender, like what happened to him. he was the best of the three, center backs. Like he was everywhere.
He was everywhere, and he was instrumental. I mean, looking at the stats, right? He had the most progressive passing distance in the entire team. Second was Amre Can, and third was Hummels, which you kind of expect out of center backs. But then Akanji was, you know, he had a stellar performance both offensively and defensively this past game, and I think really stood out of the bunch as being back on track in terms of performances.
I said this in my match ratings bit. I'm not saying he's back, but I'm close to pressing. Like, give me another maybe like one or two more performances just like that, and I'm hammering the Akanji is back button, because I've been big on Manuel Akanji. I've liked him ever since he first arrived to Dortmund. I think he has the potential to be a defensive centerpiece for as long as he's in a yellow and black kit. And it's nice to see him bounce back from recent injuries.
Definitely. I think rounding out this entire team, right, when you're talking about everyone, I think two players, without touching on Haaland, two players that had not so flashy but solid performances were both Witzel and Sancho. And I think Sancho, you know, he had that assist, which, you know, I was also really hoping him for on that final goal to play it to Pasluk.
I was looking for that too. I was like screaming at the TV, like, send it in to Pasluk now. And then he plays that a pass that I definitely didn't see that coming. That tiny little, you know, nudge forward to Erling Haaland, who just buries it.
I think it was also very funny, right? Just watching Haaland, or watching Pasluk, after every single corner kick, sprint the entire length of the field as fast as possible.
I love that. I love that in a player. I mean, because if you're Felix Pasluk, you've got nothing to lose, you know? Your fourth choice center, right? Left back.
Yes.
You're, once any of the guys that are ahead of you are coming back, you're going straight to the bench. The hell, like, screw it. Just go, you know, ball to the wall, sprint end to end. You know, nothing. What's the worst that could happen?
And I think now with Pasluk, right, you're looking at him as potentially being the backup to Guerrero instead of Nico Schultz. Nico Schultz is favored by the national team head coach, which I think is just an irony right there.
Yeah.
But I think Sancho, right, I think what was underrated entirely about his performance was how much he tied together the midfield and that forward line. I think he did a lot in terms of shuttling the ball and carrying the ball in terms of dribbling it.
Yeah, he was really good, I think, in possession. There were times where he, I think, tried to do a little too much, but, you know, that's Sancho's game. So, you take the good with the bad. But I think overall in the day, he was one of our best players. I'd say right behind Axel Witsel and Erling Haaland.
Yeah, I think it's also just kind of weird, right? Because you expect Sancho to be playing when he's playing in that front two with Erling Haaland, you expect him to be more involved in the final third than he was. But ultimately, it was him bringing the ball forward rather than Reyna, and Reyna actually finding the space underneath to actually do a lot of those things that we would have expected Sancho to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was very interesting to see. That role reversal, where I think last year you would see it from Brandt or from Hazard. They're kind of hanging back. They're almost like that playmaker, and then you allow whoever's opposite to them, which more often than not was Jadon Sancho, make those runs where he's put into a dangerous position to average like an assist a game.
And I think with Witzel, I think it was a vintage performance from him in terms of just being a anti press master and not giving the ball up.
Where there were times where there were four Gladbach players on him, and he's just like, okay, and he just, you know, passed it back to the center backs. I'd love to see Axel Witsel do surgery, because he is just ice in his veins, calm under pressure, like you want in someone in that position.
It certainly wasn't a flashy performance, and I think there was less forward passing than we kind of expected from him, but especially as things kind of got underway in the second half, he was that person to recycle play. And in the first half, he was that player to not lose the ball, which is as important as moving the ball forward at times.
Definitely.
So.
And then Erling Haaland was vintage. Erling Haaland. That run of his on the third goal, someone that size should not move that fast.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's what we all say, right? I think we've all seen how fast he can be, how strong he is, how much of a physical specimen he is. And he's very much a center forward that we haven't had in a long time, and how special he is and can be. And I think that makes a world of difference. When you're able to, I think it is frustrating not seeing him get a goal against Duisburg, but I also think his presence gives everyone on the pitch that much extra room and that much extra time and that much extra space to make something special.
Yeah, one of the things that I noticed about him in both the Duisburg game and the Gladbach game was his hold-up play. Like, he's a big dude, and he used his body so effectively time and time again in those matches to, you know, wait for reinforcements to show up or earn a foul, which he did against Duisburg, that resulted in a red card. And there were time and time again on Saturday, he was using size to his advantage and his strength to his advantage to hold up play. It was nice to see.
Yeah, and especially just having that center forward that's able to tie everyone else into the game, you know? It really is the best of two worlds, in having that physical forward, but also that forward that's able to, that wants everyone else to succeed with him.
Yeah, like I was running the Fear the Wall Twitter account this past weekend, and I said, there's no one who loves seeing his teammates score as much as he scores than Erling Haaland. Like, after Erling Haaland scored his second goal, I thought he was gonna like Hulk out on Jadon Sancho.
I mean, his face was something else to see, you know?
Yeah, like his reaction to Gio scoring the first goal, it was just like pure joy, and like, it was just pure joy. And that's what you want. That's what you want to see. He is a competitor. Like, that is in his DNA. And Dortmund actually put out like a highlight reel of him celebrating teammate scoring. And I love seeing that from someone. I love it, especially in today's age, where this is probably me being cynical. You know, everyone's like more focused on, you know, got to hit those goal incentives or those assist incentives, rather than just like, yeah, my team scored. We won. My team, I might not have performed, or if I did, cool, but my team scored.
Yeah. Looking forward at the next week and a half, there's both Augsburg, and then also, I know it's a glorified friendly, but the Super Cup against Bayern.
Mm-hmm.
Which I didn't realize was in 9 days or eight days.
Yeah.
From this
stupid summer, stupid summer Champions League.
Oh man, but I think It'll be a fantastic performance to watch. While I think Bayern, maybe this season, I think they might be a little worried about depth, especially in the midfield.
Yeah, because they just got rid of Thiago to Liverpool.
They got Thiago and they're moving Kimmich to the midfield, and they're attempting to sign Dest from Ajax for right back.
Right back depth.
Which I understand moving Kimmich to midfield, but I also think there are better midfield players than what Kimmich brings you, especially in terms of creativity. And I think Goretzka and Kimmich are both players that can do everything in the midfield, but I don't think they do one thing that special. And while they're both really, really good players, I don't think neither of them are to the level of Thiago in terms of ball retention and picking a pass and dissecting an opponent. And so it'll be interesting to see how Bayern's depth, especially in this condensed schedule, deals over the course of the season.
Yeah, I know Thiago wanted to leave. He wanted to go to Liverpool, you know, play for Klopp. Who doesn't? But I do think, Goretzka's a good player. I think Kimmich is one. I think he's one of the best athletes in the Bundesliga, maybe in all of like German soccer. So he's able to play those. You're right. Like, he's able to do a lot of things well, but he's not able to do what you need him to do at the position that you're playing him at well enough. So I am interested to see how they're able to play. They're able to make it work.
It'll be interesting to see Favre's ideas against Bayern and see how he expects to line up against them and which areas of the pitch he wants to exploit. But I think that's probably the most we're going to get out of that game.
Right. For the record, I'm totally fine with, you know, losing the Super Cup. As nice as it is to, like, say, yeah, we won a trophy this year, it is a glorified friendly. I'm totally fine with, you know, losing that game if it means we're not going to lose a starter to injury.
Yeah, entirely. And then this upcoming Saturday, I'm pretty sure. I need to relook at the date.
Yep, Saturday the 26th at 9:30 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, the best time standard in the world. We're at Augsburg.
I got to see if I can watch that because I have a group meeting then. But yes, I do have group meetings for schoolwork at 9 a.m. in the morning. It's wonderful.
Especially on Saturday.
So Augsburg, they won their first game against Union Berlin. I did not watch it.
Me neither.
They won 3-1, and I think, you know, Union Berlin was a solid side in the Bundesliga last season, so it'll be interesting to see what happens, especially with Augsburg being a team that tends to sit back more and attempt to play on the counter.
Mm-hmm. It would be interesting because the last time we played them there, yeah, we won 5-3, but until Erling Haaland came on, we were down, what was it, like 3-1?
Yeah.
If it weren't for Haaland, you know, going beast mode on them, that's a game that I don't see us, because I remember that game very well. We were on the ropes in that because we had just given up a ridiculous goal from midfield from their player. So that's, yeah, you know, I think it will be interesting because they do like to play defensively against us. It's at their home stadium, which I don't know if that means anything, you know, in the COVID world. But it'll be. I'm excited. I'm excited to see how this iteration of Dortmund breaks down that defense.
It's also a new iteration of Augsburg losing Philipp Max to PSV Eindhoven over the course of the summer.
Mm-hmm.
So that'll be an advantage to Dortmund. But, you know, they, of course, have Vargas and Gregoric and Caligiuri and Niederlechner. So, I mean, they're also just a very physical front line. They have a very physical center midfield with Kadir's younger brother in there. And they're just a very industrious side overall. So I think this game could range anywhere from a counterattack fest, especially on Augsburg's, to Augsburg's benefit. It could be an absolute demolition job, or it could just be a game where it's absolutely disgusting to watch because of how physical it is and we just fall asleep.
Yeah, I could see it going either way. Do you think Favre changes the 11 at all based on, you know, like the physicality and the compactness that Augsburg present, or is it just, you know, roll out the starting the same starting 11?
I think that's an interesting question. I can see him adjusting the shape a little bit to include Royce in that front three. I could see him. I think Pasalic starts. You don't really have another option on that side. I know Guerrero and Schultz are back in training, but I don't think either of them are fit.
Mm-hmm.
And with that said, I can also see maybe someone like Matteo Mori instead of Meunier on that right side.
Yeah, I like Meunier, the games that he played towards the end of last year. I thought he brought something different from Hakimi. Almost more of a defensive presence, but he very good contributing on the attack. So I could see Mori start. I could see Meunier back in that position. I could see Royce moving in for Gio Reyna. Same thing with Brandt for Reyna. There's a lot of options available for us. So I'm interested to see where it goes. I could also see a same starting 11 where we just, screw it. This worked in the first game against a superior opponent. Let's just see what happens against an inferior opponent.
I'm interested to see how Favre attempts to combat Augsburg's physicality, whether he tries to put a more physical player in for Bellingham and Delaney, or whether he puts a more creative player like Brandt in to unlock a potential low block. I also think this is the type of game Hakimi would have struggled in last year, especially against a low block, especially against a team that likes to counter and would definitely see him be caught out of position.
I wouldn't mind seeing Brandt in for Bellingham. I remember Brandt was the best player, not named Erling Haaland, in that Augsburg game. I think you need that creativity that Bellingham doesn't have yet, but Brandt definitely offers. And I thought when he was next to Witzel, he was more often than not the best player on the pitch, far and away.
I would also agree with that. But then you also need to look, I think, especially with there not really being a possession-based battle in the midfield, I can very much see Brandt kind of taking that free roaming role from Gio Reyna instead. But I think that also takes away from just the amount of presence you have in that front line of just having two players versus three players.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Brandt is definitely more positioned to be in a deeper creative role than in that front three, or in a front three that's built with two wingers. And while that kind of false 10 position that Reyna has been playing definitely frees up a role that would definitely suit Brandt or Royce's skill sets more.
Yeah, we're just going to have to wait and see, I guess. I don't envy, like I said, the attacking riches that we have on the bench is just, it's ridiculous. Yeah, we're the second biggest team in Germany, but still, like, it's insane that you can put on the field late in the game Marco Reus and Julian Brandt. Marco Reus, the former German player of the year, and Julian Brandt, a rising German star. that you can as subs, as late game, ice the game subs. That's that is just unbelievable.
I think one, it speaks to how talented Reyna and Sancho are, but I also think, right, more and more, I think we saw Brandt being the odd man out in last year's setup, and it'll be interesting to see whether that development continues.
Mm-hmm.
Because you kind of, especially with Favre, really needs to figure out that puzzle in how he can build a team around someone that talented and consistently get the best out of him, because we consistently saw the best and worst out of Brandt last year.
Yeah. Yeah. So if you do put Brandt in there, does that mean that Witzel is going to have to drop back deeper as more of the defensive center mid, or do you run the risk, do you put Thomas Delaney in there and run the risk of him giving up a stupid free kick in prime scoring space for Augsburg?
Well, I think it all comes down to what Favre wants to do. If he wants to have a physical bloodbath in the midfield, he's going to put Delaney in. I think that takes away from the amount of creativity you have on the pitch. I also think it prevents Witzel being in a single pivot where he does a lot of the defensive work, where he has to recycle play a lot. And it also gives you more coverage on counterattacks. And Delaney being there offers a fourth player back, with Witzel being a little bit more advanced. I'd prefer to see Bellingham out there for at least the first half. I know it's taboo to, sub a player before the 55th minute, before the 60th minute, but I think I would do Witzel, Bellingham, and Brandt, because of how creative Brandt is in that, and have him in that false 10 position behind either Royce or Sancho and Erling Haaland. And then potentially, if it gets into a closer game situation, moving Brandt deeper next to Witzel, and then kind of playing a midfield triangle of Witzel deeper next to Brandt and someone like Reyna, or Brandt and someone like even Royce, with Sancho and Erling Haaland up top, and see how crazy that would be.
Yeah, I don't know, man. Like, I'm not very good at coming up with lineups to begin with, but I would not mind seeing that. I honestly wouldn't mind seeing Brandt in starting in that deeper central midfield role, kind of like the like a deep lying playmaker mixed with an advanced playmaker. Because that's his specialty. Like, he's not a winger. I don't particularly like – I hadn't liked him when he was further up the pitch last year. I think he's good in that deep-lying, pick guys out with big passes or make good runs and allowing other guys to get freed up. And then next to him, I would like to see either a Delaney or an Axel Witzel, because they're just – Delaney's your designated defender. And Witzel can do a little bit of both, but I think he's good in defense.
Yeah, I mean, I think deeper is where Brandt really shines, but I think it's also down to Favre on how conservative he wants to start the game versus how aggressive he wants to start the game.
Mm-hmm.
That's the spectrum on which you need to gauge everything. You could put out a team with Witzel as your most defensive player and really just go for it. Or, you can start out with balance and make adjustments going further into the game as you either become more desperate or more comfortable with your lead.
Mm-hmm.
And then also, I would also really like to see Brandt in his position, because I think I recall De Hood playing in Reyna's position towards the end of last year in a 3-5-2, right? And
I think
De Hood perfectly works for that role because he just likes to dribble in space, and I think that front two really likes to – that front two gives behind a lot of space underneath, right?
Mm-hmm.
Brandt would do perfectly to take advantage of a lot of that, but I think you'd also need more runners in front of him from the wingbacks in order to really make the most out of it.
Yeah, I will see. You know, it could go either way. We could either go super attacking or a little more conservative, and neither option would surprise me. Because Favre, like, I know he has his favorites. I know he really doesn't rotate, but he is, you know, he's a pretty good tactician. So I think, you know, with some, you know, minor blemishes, but other than that, like, I think he knows what he's doing, and he's I do trust him to put out a winning lineup for us.
Definitely.
And Weston McKennie can, you know, starting for Juventus, can kind of rope into Schalke being a dumpster fire.
I've never really, like, I'll criticize Schalke's transfer on that because, yes, he was a highlight on their team, but I've never really been that high on McKennie. Like, to me, I think he's like...
He's like a safety. He's a strong safety in football. Like, he's there defensively. He's not going to get you a lot of interceptions or turnovers. Like, he's not going to – like, he's going to get you a lot of tackles, a lot of – you know, a lot of passes broken up. And maybe he'll contribute on, like, returns or something like that. Like, he's a defensive specialist. And that's fine.
To me, he's a rich man, Scott McTominay.
Uh-huh.
Which isn't a bad thing. It's just like I think, especially when you come to like Juventus, right?
Yeah.
There's gonna be super high expectations of what he's actually gonna do, but really, like, he just needs to get the ball, protect the back line, and keep possession. And on a side like Juve, you know, that's not too hard to do.
Yeah.
Especially when you have Aaron Ramsey progressing the ball next to you, and you have probably. And you have Rabiot also. I mean, I think he'd work perfectly next to Rabiot in that way. But
mm-hmm. Yeah, he did. I don't really know how good Sampdoria is, but he still did, like, really well. He almost had 2 goals on his debut, which is insane. Like, U.S. soccer Twitter, I think, would have had, like, a nuclear meltdown if that happened.
I just don't think he's, like, you know, I think... Everyone excited about Pulisic, right? Okay, fair. Mm-hmm. But I can see that effect of that overhyping of Pulisic coming back into play when it comes to McKennie now that he's at a big club and like putting in solid performances. Like he has the potential to be a very solid defensive midfielder, but especially if you're limiting his role. That allows him to be that much better of a player than he actually is.
Yeah. I don't know. It could be the case of, like, he was limited. Like, you saw a lot of the parts of his game that needed to be improved because of he was the best player on Schalke, so they're expecting him to be an attacking presence, which he's not exactly, while being a defender, which... He is, and he's surrounded by not that good players and poor coaching. Whereas it's Juventus, like, it's the best team in Italy. Pirlo's unproven as a manager, but, you know, give him a game, give him like a set game plan and a set position to play, and I think he'll give you a solid 90 minutes. Because I'm sure, like, I think the only positions that Weston didn't play at Schalke was goalkeeper. I just remember seeing the lineups, and he was playing, like, everywhere.
I remember him playing center forward because Schalke didn't have a center forward anymore.
Right, and he's such a presence in the air. Like, you just, like, lob across it, and Adar is going to get ahead to it.
I mean, I think he's a good player. I just don't, you know, I think he... I don't think he's a world-class creative player. I don't think he's a – I think what he does what he does very well.
Mm-hmm.
I think in the right team, that could be awesome. I don't think we've learned enough about his press resistance, like, you know, like comparing him to someone like Thiago or Axel Witsel. You know, that's just not a reality.
Yeah, like that's not the kind of player that he is. And that's something that I think that he can learn at Juventus. Like, he's got, I think, some of the best players in the world around him. You know, like, hopefully he's going to learn. And that's really all you can hope for.
Yeah, that's fair.